All right. So I know we're like on the other side of Easter now, but we're still in the Passion account in John. So I'm going to back up and kind of overlap where we were last week. So Jesus has been arrested in the garden. Judas has betrayed him. The disciples have deserted him. And then he's taken to Annas and then to Caiaphas. In that process, Peter denies him three times, and that's what we focused on last week. Then here we are this week, John 18:28-32. They brought Jesus from Caiaphas, and again, John doesn't really say what happened in, with the Caiaphas trial, if you will, or interview. He just goes from Annas to Caiaphas and now straight to the Praetorium, which is the governor's residence. And it says, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter the Praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. They are incredible hypocrites, right? Well, we need to be holy enough to eat the Passover. So we're going to stand out here so that the governor will come out, and then we're going to try to get this guy executed by crucifixion. Unbelievable. Therefore, Pilate came out to them and said, what accusation are you bringing against this man? They answered and said to him, if this man were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you. So Pilate said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. The Jews said to him, we're not permitted to put anyone to death. This happened so that the word of Jesus, which he said, indicating what kind of death he was going to die, would be fulfilled. So a couple of details that I didn't cover in this passage last week. First of all, it says it was early. So I did talk about the fact last week that the trial, the so-called trial that Jesus underwent, Annas would not be necessarily considered a trial. It was more, this is the man that they recognized as the official high priest from the Jewish perspective, because the high priest was supposed to be elected for life. Right. But going back to the Greek era, when the Greeks were in control of Israel, the high priest was appointed because it was such a powerful political position. It would be like a combination of a prime minister and a Supreme Court justice. If you can just imagine somebody that has that kind of power. Right. We don't have prime ministers. So think of a president, you know, the president of the United States, except the president, you know, we separate out our branches of government, right? You know, we have the judicial branch and the executive branch and the legislative branch and so forth. And in other countries, so countries that have a prime minister, what you have is you have a legislative branch that essentially a majority of, you know, group in that branch are allowed to select the prime minister, who effectively becomes what for us would be the president, okay? So that's why I said prime minister, because it would be very similar. In other words, it's a very powerful position. So the Greeks and then now the Romans were very concerned that this person be under their control. Well, so the Jews were not really happy with the fact that they keep, you know, appointing new high priests. So they would have recognized Annas as being the real high priest. But if they're going to get anything done officially and legally, then Jesus has got to go to Caiaphas. Caiaphas is Annas's son-in-law. And I think I mentioned this last week. Annas, so well-respected, five of his sons became high priests, right? They just, you know, the high priest couldn't serve for very long. And so as a result, you know, it's kind of like our president, you know, every 4 years you had to keep putting somebody new in. But Annas had this incredibly powerful persuasion, influence. And so that's why they took him to Annas first. Then they took him to Caiaphas. Again, we don't have the record of what happened with Caiaphas. I think I read the portion from Mark last week of what took place. Maybe I didn't. Let me read this because I think I might have skipped over this. This is what happened. So again, where we are in John, he's taken from Annas to Caiaphas, and then boom, from Caiaphas right out to Pilate. But here's what happened with Caiaphas. This is Mark 14, 55 through 65. Now, the chief priests and the entire council were trying to obtain testimony against Jesus to put him to death, and they were not finding any. For many people were giving false testimony against him, and so their testimonies were not consistent. And then some stood up and began giving false testimony against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that was made by hands, and in 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" Well, Jesus did say that, but he was referring to the temple of his body, right? "And not even in this respect was their testimony consistent. And then the high priest stood up," this is Caiaphas, "and came forward and questioned Jesus, saying, 'Do you not offer any answer for what these men are testifying against you?' But he kept silent," that is, Jesus kept silent, "and did not offer any answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him." And so when it says high priest here, it's Caiaphas. "And said, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?' And Jesus said, 'I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' Tearing his clothes," this is a big act, okay? "The high priest said, 'What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. How does it seem to you?' And they all condemned him as deserving of death. And some began to spit on him and blindfolded him and beat him with their fists and said to him, 'Prophesy.' Then the officers took custody of him and slapped him in the face." So John is predicated on the fact that the other gospels are already out there, and these other facts are already well established and well known. In fact, now we get to Pilate, and it doesn't even say anything about him. It says they brought Jesus from Caiaphas into the praetorium, and it was early. Okay, so the praetorium, they would have all known that's the governor's residence. They didn't enter because of the Passover. "Therefore, Pilate came out to them." It doesn't say who Pilate is. It just says, "Therefore, Pilate came out to him." Well, we know who Pilate is because we've read the other gospels. Everybody else that encountered John, because it's the last gospel, would have been familiar with Pilate, right? So who was Pilate? Pilate was the governor of the province of Judea, and his technical title was prefect. He was the prefect. Later, that title was a synonymous title was procurator. So you may have heard Pilate referred to as the procurator, all right? But the title that would have been used in Pilate's during Pilate's time was prefect, right? But that most of your modern translations would just say governor, because that's what he was appointed to do and to be. He governed Judea from AD 26 through 36. So Jesus could have been tried and executed as early as 30 or as late as 33. There are a few commentators that would even push it later. We always want to see Jesus entering his ministry when he was 30. Okay, that's when someone would have been accepted as having the maturity to be a rabbi. But Luke is the one that says, "And when Jesus was about 30 years old." And I've read commentators that say he could have been as old as 37. So again, we need to understand something. We're so obsessed with our birthdays. This is my birthday, you know, this is my birthday month, you know, these people would be lucky if they even knew how old they were. I bet you know how old you are. I bet, you know, you talk to kids and they're like, "I'm 7 and a half, you know? So, but these people, yeah, they just didn't. I was listening to this book that I'm listening to right now, read by Bono. It's called Surrender, 40 Songs of Something. Anyway, it's basically like a autobiography of Bono and U2, which this is about the third one. I read one back in the late 80s, right? But they've had a lot of cultural impact, and most of it pretty positive. So it's been interesting. But Bono was a strong advocate for getting AIDS medication to people in Africa back in the early 2000s. He was an activist, but he's essentially using his celebrity in a positive way. And he was trying to get the United States to donate the money to buy these AIDS drugs. Okay. AIDS, if you got AIDS, you know, back in the 80s, I mean, you had 5 years to live. I remember when Magic Johnson got AIDS and I was like, oh, wow, you know, he's going to be, you know, dead in 5 years or 6 years or whatever. No, he came in, his diagnosis came in, HIV, late enough that they had these drugs available. And so, long story short, Magic Johnson is still with us 25 years later, 30 years later, whatever. But in Africa, it's still a death sentence. Well, the concern that was expressed was these people don't wear watches. They don't have clocks. Many of these tribal people in Africa have never seen a clock. So you have to take this medication at certain times of day. How are they going to know to take the medication during that time of day? And that was used in a way, you know, to try to say, well, don't worry about it because they're not even going to be able to take the pills anyway, blah, blah, blah. And it's just a way of dismissing it from your mind. But it reminds me of, you know, people that lived in other time periods were that way as well. They weren't obsessed with time like you and I. People in other parts of the world to this day, even in, so Africa represents a lot of developing nations, but even in nations that would be considered, you know, more developed that do have access to clocks and all of that, they don't necessarily care, you know? So time is just a different perspective with different people. So all that to say, that's probably too much information about that. We don't know exactly how old Jesus was. We don't know exactly what year he was crucified, but we know he was crucified during the reign of Pontius. Reign, that's not even really the procuratorship of Pontius Pilate. So somewhere between 26 and 36. Shortly after Pilate's arrival, he offended the Jews by bringing a Roman military insignia with the emperor's image. I'm assuming this is like a big flag, and bringing that into Jerusalem. And they were just, you know, greatly offended at the idolatry of that. He also brought in these ornamental shields with his name and the name of the emperor. So he just really, when he first got there, just dismissed the Jewish traditions and their very, very strong affinity for, you know, there is only one God and we're only going to worship one God and we're not going to worship the emperor. And, you know, you're not going to bring these images into our city or into our temple. Philo and Josephus, this is a quote from Erdman's Bible Dictionary, I think. Philo and Josephus portray him as inflexible, corrupt, and cruel. Well, this would seem to be supported by Luke's gospel. If you remember, Luke mentions, quote, the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mixed with their sacrifices. So Pilate was, you know, he was a Roman and he didn't want to have anything to do with these people. And if they didn't want to listen to him, then he was, you know, good, then execute him. I don't care. Well, he got himself in a lot of trouble with the Jews. He stirred up a lot of revolt. And so the ruler that was over him started to call him to account. So he kind of started backing away from that. And that may well explain why Pilate was more willing to try to let Jesus go. Because if you read, as we read this account, you see that Pilate says, I don't find any, you know, anything to charge him with. You know, you take care of him. First, he's like, you know, that's about your law. You take care of it. And then, okay, listen, I'll scourge him and I'll let him go. And it was the you know, religious elite, essentially, these religious leaders that were stirring up the crowd, the very same crowd that had said 5 days earlier, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, this is the Messiah, are now screaming, crucify, crucify. So, guys, long story short, don't go along with a mob, right? Don't just follow the crowd. The crowd often goes the wrong direction. You do remember the pandemic, right? okay? You remember Black Lives Matter, all right? It's such a great phrase, except those of us who understood the origin of the movement and who was running it realized that it wasn't about black people who matter. It's a Marxist movement that's designed to stir people up. And essentially, in the long term, all of these Marxist-oriented movements are intended to sow seeds to disrupt our culture and our society, to destabilize the government. I mean, so there's this incredible intolerance for what happened in the wake of Biden's election, okay? And granted, you know, there was a big protest in Washington. You know, I saw it. There were some, you know, things that were definitely wrong about that. But what about the fact that cities were burning during BLM? They didn't go after any of those people, right? All I'm saying is don't follow the crowd. Don't follow the mob, right? So my take on BLM when all of that was going on in the wake of the George Floyd murder was I just changed the terms. You know, black people matter. Black lives do matter, right? But I'm not going to do hashtag BLM. And, you know, so now, again, if you just back up and you give yourself some time, you gain perspective. You see, oh, well, wait a minute. Okay, so this isn't what we thought it was, right? And we had a huge, you know, protest here in downtown Garland in the wake of that. But it was peaceful. There were actually Garland police officers that were out there. There were a number of speakers. Craig and his daughter Jubilee were out there. And, you know, I'm like just trying to protect the church. And I went out there. I sat on the bench in front of the church. I'm like, I don't need a Molotov cocktail flying through the front window, right? Because, you know, you saw that happening in other cities. But I'm not going to follow a mob, right? And that's why I didn't. So right as the George Floyd thing happened, I didn't throw up a bunch of posts on my social media because they immediately arrested Derek Chauvin, right? There wasn't like this big, you know, blue wall that went up as has been the case in a number of other cases, situations. But I just don't like following mobs. I don't know if you remember, this has probably been, it was a little bit before George Floyd and all of that. But Kanye West was going around and portraying himself as this big Christian. And, you know, he had like this gospel, these gospel singers and all of this. I was actually interviewed for the Dallas Observer concerning that. And I said, you know what? I said, I'm not going to jump on that bandwagon because I don't know what Kanye West really thinks or really feels or whether this is going to last, you know. Because I can remember all the way back to when Bob Dylan was a Christian for a short period of time. And he even released a couple of projects, right? One was called Shot of Love. The first one was called Slow Train Coming, something like that. And they were great songs if you like Bob Dylan. And I've never been a big Bob Dylan fan, but, you know, nonetheless. But even then, you know, he was like a Christian for 2, 3, 4 years. And then he was not a Christian again. And now, you know, the stuff that's gone on with Kanye West. I mean, the guy's got some serious psychological problems. I don't jump on bandwagons. Don't follow mobs. Don't let people drive you just to do whatever they think you should do. And it's hard to resist that. I think most people that go to this church, though, are not like that. I don't think you'd be going to a small church like this if you were, hey, I want to fit in and, you know, I'm going to church to be seen. You know, if that was the case, you'd be going to like, you know, some gargantuan church somewhere and, you know, wearing your fancy clothes and see, I'm Christian and all of that. So I don't think y'all are like that. But don't follow them up because that's, I think that's what happens with people. Here's a quote from Erdman's Dictionary of the Bible regarding Pilate. Pilate's tendency to react with force led to his removal from office. A Samaritan prophet said that he would produce the temple vessels, which the Samaritans believed were buried on Mount Gerizim. The crowd assembled to see this wonder. The crowd assembled to see this wonder was attacked, and some were executed later. This is because of Pilate. Vitellus, legate of Syria, this would be the one that was over Pilate, ordered Pilate recalled to Rome in AD 36 in answer for the incident. So this can help us to understand some of what was going on when we have this situation with Pilate trying to placate all of these different people, okay? Okay, so last week we talked about the fact that they say, the Jewish leaders say, we're not permitted to put anyone to death. As I said last week, that may have been the fact that Rome did not allow capital punishment to be applied by anyone other than Rome. However, Stephen was stoned to death just, you know, months later after this, the first martyr, Stephen, read Acts chapter 7. But that may have been an act, just a rash act. They just dragged him out of the city and just did it, right? Not caring about what the consequences were. But it also may well have been that they recognized, that is, the Jewish leaders recognized, that their trial of Jesus wasn't legal. First of all, you couldn't have a trial at night. And the first interview, which, and really, maybe even some of or all of the trial with Caiaphas was at night. Secondly, you couldn't have a trial on the day before a Sabbath. This was the day before a Sabbath, okay? Or on the day before a feast. This was the day before a feast, right? And so on multiple fronts, this was an illegal trial. So they may have said, well, it's not legal for us to put him to death because they knew it wasn't in accordance with their law. But hey, if we can drag him in front of Pilate and get Pilate to do it, he's a Gentile, right? So nonetheless, Jesus is going to be crucified because he said, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw men unto myself, right? That's from John chapter 12. And then Jesus alluded to this when he had the interview with Nicodemus because he spoke of the serpent that was raised up, right? That healed, the people were healed if they looked upon the servant. So must the Son of Man be raised up. So he was telling us prophetically that he was going to be crucified. All right, let's go to the next passage or we're never going to get out of John. So now John 18, 33 through 40 says this. Therefore, Pilate entered the praetorium again and summoned Jesus and said to him, "You are the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would be fighting so I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore, Pilate said to him, "So, you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this purpose I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And after saying this, he came out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no grounds at all for charges in his case. However, you have a custom that I release one prisoner for you at the Passover. Therefore, do you wish that I release for you the king of the Jews?" So they shouted again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now, Barabbas was a rebel, right? So very interesting. This brings us to a passage that contains verses from the oldest fragment of the New Testament in existence. It is called Ryland's Greek Fragment 457, and it contains John 18, 31 through 33 on one side and 18, 37 through 38 on the other side. You know, I completely forgot, Lige. I was going to have the picture of this. If you look in the bin there under either teaching or pictures, there's an outside possibility that that might be there. And if you happen to find it, you can throw it up there. But it's my fault for not putting it in there. It's called P52 or Ryland's Fragment 457. Did you find it? Okay. So this small little fragment of parchment is from John's Gospel. It's 9 centimeters high. And on one side, it's in the pistograph, which means that it's got writing on both sides. On one side, it contains part of verses 31 through 33 of John 18. And on the other side, part of verses 37 through 38. It is one of the collection of Greek papyri in the John Ryland's Library, which is why it's called Ryland's Greek 457. But the reason why I'm bringing that to you, in addition to the fact that it contains these verses, is because it dates between 100 and 150 AD, making it the oldest piece of the New Testament in existence, right? Now, we have an entire Bible that dates from the 4th century or 5th, early 5th, no, 4th century, mid 4th century, Codex Sinaiticus. And you could type that in on your browser in whatever search engine that you use. And just think of, it's called Sinaiticus because much of it was in St. Catherine's Monastery in which is at the base of Mount Sinai, or what they believe to be Mount Sinai. So if you type in Sinai, S-I-N-A-I, and then add cus, Sinaiticus, all right? And then use the word codex. Codex just means a book. Then it will take you, one of responses in your search engine will be the actual official site for this, and you can look at it. It's the whole Bible. In Greek, right? Now, it's in some, you know, parts of it are, you know, in rough shape. The reason why we can have a New Testament the way we have it is because we have over 500 different manuscripts of varying sizes that date before 500 AD, okay? And so what we do when we assemble our Bible is they put all of those together, okay? But interestingly, in these verses is that very, very famous saying where Pilate interviews Jesus, asks him if he's a king. Jesus said, I came to testify to the truth. And Pilate says, what does Pilate say? What is truth? In Latin, quid est veritas. You know, Pilate sounds strangely contemporary to me. There's a whole lot of people today that are like, what is truth? Truth is what I want to make it. Truth is my truth, right? Well, Pilate was a politician. He had no desire to be used as a tool by the Jewish politicians. He was uninterested in the Jewish religion and its laws. And this is also a perspective that was shared by probably many other Roman politicians, but in part, certainly shared by Gallio. I'm not going to read it in the interest of time, but if you go to Acts 18, 12 through 17, you will see that Paul is dragged before the proconsul of Achaia, a man named Gallio, and they're trying to get Paul arrested for sharing the gospel. And Gallio's like, those are your, you know, religious questions. I'm not interested in that. In fact, they even beat the ruler of the synagogue right in front of Gallio, and he didn't care. Like, oh, you know, whatever. In fact, I'll read that last verse. This is Acts 18, 17. But they all took hold of Sosthenes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. And yet Gallio was not concerned about any of these things. So I'm sorry for laughing, but it's just like, you know, they wanted to use the government to get their bidding done. You know, this is a reason for a pause. I very strongly believe in the separation of church and state. I really do. you know, people are like, oh, they took prayer out of the schools. I don't want teachers leading your kids in prayer. Who knows what that teacher believes? I don't know what their faith tradition is. Okay. I respect Mormons. I respect Muslims. But I don't want them leading your kids in prayer. You follow what I'm saying? In fact, these days, even churches that were once mainstream have some weird idea. I don't want them leading your kid. I don't want them teaching your kids about the Bible. That's not the place of the public school. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm in disagreement with kids being able to express their faith. Sure. That doesn't mean I am opposed to a teacher saying, you know, this is my faith tradition. That's fine. Okay. Or a kid, you know, a teacher answering questions about their faith tradition. I don't have a problem with that. That's not establishing. Right? That doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. The reason Baptists came into existence is because of the Anglican Church. They're dissenters. They were not allowed to worship the way they wanted to worship. And so that's the reason Baptists came to this country in the very, very earliest days. In fact, the famous wall of separation between church and state, that phrase is found in a letter from Thomas Jefferson to a group of Baptists in Danvers, I think, Connecticut. And he was assuring them, no, we're not going to have an established church in this country, right? There's a wall of, I want the wall there. I want it to be high, right? It doesn't bother me at all if they want to take, you know, 10 commandments off of government property and all of that. It's innocuous, right? Our laws going all the way back do have an affinity with that. It doesn't establish a church, but I would rather that than a statue of Baphomet being in the, you know, the Capitol, which is what happened in Iowa or Idaho or something. I mean, we're off the rails insane. Okay. Keep the state separate from the church and let me teach and let us teach what the Bible says, right? And if you want to take your kid to an expressly Christian school, then they can teach in accordance with what, you know, you believe the Bible says. But this is the problem. These leaders, these Jewish leaders, were using the state to get their job done. This happens on the left and on the right in this country. It's like whoever's in power wants the state to enforce, you know, their will. And no, I don't want that, right? Not at all. I think we need to keep it separate. Well, Pilate was responsible for upholding Roman law and keeping the Pax Romana, all right? You guys have been in Craig's Bible study, and you know the Pax Romana is the Roman peace, and the Romans were primarily interested in keeping the peace, right? And this is why Judea was such a difficult province to lead, because they didn't want Rome in control. And so there were constant uprisings, right? Interestingly, one of the insurrectionists, it's funny to me that, you know, that certain day back in January of 2021 is called an insurrection. You don't know what an insurrection is. This guy's name was Barabbas, and he did start an insurrection and murdered people. And that's the guy that they released instead of Jesus. Wow. But Pilate's just trying to keep the peace. The peace wasn't being threatened by Jesus, but the Jewish religious leaders who'd instigated his arrest and trial, they were the ones threatening the peace. Pilate finds Jesus' claim to be the king in another realm unimportant. The Lord goes on to say that he's come into the world to testify to the truth. And sadly, Pilate shows no interest in that either. So he says very clearly, I find no grounds at all for charges in this case. However, you have a custom, right? Well, Barabbas was in actuality what Jesus had been accused of. But Jesus was innocent. Barabbas was guilty. The guilty went free. You understand the significance there, right? We're the guilty. Jesus goes to the cross for us. Okay? We can't say with any certainty that Barabbas responded positively to, you know, being released and Jesus essentially dying in his place. But you should. You should. You and I should live our lives differently, right? We should live our lives differently. Our response to that should be gratitude, right? It should be love, and it should result in repentance, because Jesus went to the cross where you and I deserve to go, right? Sin, the soul that sins, it shall surely die. That's what Ezekiel said. But the wages of sin is death. That's what we owe. Jesus paid that penalty. And we see that symbolized right here. The theological significance of Jesus dying instead of Barabbas is obvious. The sacrificial lamb dies in place of the guilty. You and I are Barabbas. The question is, do you realize what it means for Jesus to die in your place? And are you willing to change the direction of your life as you receive Christ's sacrifice? He didn't die for me to go on and sin willfully. He didn't die so I could just go on, you know, living the way I've always lived. He died so my sin would be not just excused. That's not what forgiveness means. Forgiveness doesn't mean your sin is excused. Forgiveness means your sin is removed. That's what the Greek word means. Aphiemi means to remove. He died to take away sins. So I need to recognize that. I need to realize that. And I need to live my life differently as a result. Amen? All right. God bless you guys. Thanks for joining us online.